The following audio program is suitable for all ages. It's August 28th, 2005, and you're tuned in to the RetroBits podcast. Hi, I'm your host, Earl Evans. And this is the show where we talk about computing like we did it back in the day. That's right, here we're all about old school computing and modern day fun. If it's got 8 bits, paper tape, punch cards, cartridge slots, BASIC and ROM, or if it's just plain old, then you have found the right podcast. We're up to show number 9, and today's show is The Bulletin Board System, Part 1. That's right, this is a Part 1 of 2. Not exactly sure when Part 2 is going to come around. It may be next week or the week after, so stay tuned for that. And as always, welcome to the program. For any new listeners, we're glad to have you aboard, and for folks that have been with us for a while, thanks for coming back. You can get more information on this show at our podcast site, and that is at http://retrobits, that's retrobits.libsyn.com. Or you can send email to the show at retrobits@gmail.com. And I'm always happy to get some emails, so if you've got any comments at all or just want to drop us a line for any reason, feel free to do so. Always happy to see some things in the inbox. On a personal level, summer's starting to come to a close, and it's starting to get apparent here in Portland, Oregon. Some of the fall weather began to creep in on us today, and I understand from the news reports that we're going to have a little bit more of that as the week goes on. So all these weeks of blue sky and warm air may be coming to an end. The kids are gearing up to go back to school. And an exciting time, my son's birthday is coming up. He's pretty excited about that. After that, it'll be my own, then my daughter's, and then Christmas. So, wow, the fall season is really almost upon us. And all the holidays, that's always such a fun time of year for all of us, and especially when you have kids. And, you know, who knows? Maybe I'll put some retro computing stuff on my Christmas list this year. Anyway, my wife, Jill, she's just a beautiful lady. She's really fantastic, and she keeps everything in all of our lives straight. I'm imagining that she's probably going to be happy to have just a little bit of a rest when the kids go back to school, so that'd be good for her and good for them. I think both of them are actually looking forward to getting back into the school swing of things. My son's going into the second grade. My daughter's going into the first. And so, anyway, ought to be an interesting year. This last week on my retro hobby, I did make a rather costly excursion out onto eBay, as it turns out. I purchased myself an Atari 800 computer in ostensibly good working condition. Actually, the photos of it look excellent, and also a 1050 disk drive. I'm still waiting for it to arrive in the mail, waiting anxiously, as you might imagine. And when it gets here, I'm probably going to also get one of those SIO to PC cables that I've talked about, which will enable the Atari computer to talk to my PC and do things like use the PC as a disk drive, or other things. So that'll be good. The other things include you can actually talk to an Atari disk drive direct from the PC if you have the right kind of cable, and that's the one I'm going to get. Also, this last week, I've been trying to battle for time on my Commodore 128 now that my daughter has discovered the game Frogger. So it turns out that these retro games do still have quite the appeal, and so it's her and I fighting for the joystick. And of course, in that scenario, you can imagine who wins. Of course, it's her. But, you know, she goes to bed earlier than I do. So the other thing I've been doing is BBSing. And that brings me in record time directly into the topic for tonight's show. I would talk about email, but this was an extremely slow week. In fact, I don't think I got any emails at all this past week. So, hey, where are you guys? Hello? Hello, send email, woohoo. And then I'll talk about it on the show and stuff. And, you know, you'll, well, unfortunately, I don't have fabulous prizes to give away. Maybe someday. But, you know, this last week I did some BBSing. It's something that I haven't done in a while. And part of what spurred me on was watching some of a fantastic documentary work called the BBS documentary. We're going to have quite a few excerpts from that production on today's show. That particular work is licensed under something called Creative Commons. The closest thing that I could think of to Creative Commons is like open source for creative material like audio and video and artwork and that kind of thing. The link for the Creative Commons website will be up on the show notes. And if you're more interested in what that's all about, you can check it out. Creative Commons has a variety of different license types that enable you to keep certain control over your own work and how it's used while at the same time making your artistic work available to the community. It's a really fantastic program, and the creator of this BBS documentary, Jason Scott, licensed this work under Creative Commons. So just, you know, fantastic. But I'm getting ahead of myself. First, let me tell you about the poking around that I did this last week. Of course, bulletin board systems are computer systems that were attached to modems. You would dial these BBS systems from your computer system using a modem and some terminal software, some terminal emulation software. Kind of similar to something like CompuServe or AOL or that sort of thing, but run by individuals. And these systems that people offered had user forums where people could communicate. You could email to each other before internet email was as prevalent as it is today. There were software files and places for you to upload software files if you had programs or documents that you wanted to share with the other people on the BBS. Then there were also online games that you could play on the BBS systems. They could run external programs that, as I recall, were called doors. And your access levels on the BBS varied depending on how long you'd been on and whatsoever relationship you had with the person who ran the BBS, called the system operator or SysOp. Anyway, it was wonderful. BBSs began in the late 70s. They had their heyday in the 80s and early 90s. And then, as you'll hear on some of the excerpts that we'll play, they started to decline rapidly in the mid-90s after the advent of the World Wide Web. But many still exist today, and they can be contacted, some by dial-up and some via Telnet, which is an interactive terminal protocol on the internet. This is the way that I did some BBSing this last week. I did some of what's called Tel BBSing. Like I said, many of these bulletin boards are still available. To access them, it's really interesting how you do this. You take your retro computer and you connect it with a serial line to your PC. On the PC, you run some software that emulates a modem, and then the PC acts as a gateway. Your terminal package on your retro computer doesn't know the difference. As far as it's concerned, it's talking to something like a Hayes-compatible modem. So it dials out, and when it does, the gateway program on your PC establishes a connection to the BBS over the internet using the Telnet protocol. On the other side, if the BBS SysOp is running their BBS in the retro style, they may be using similar technology on their PC to translate from the internet back to a serial line and using a classic bulletin board system software. And again, it doesn't know the difference. As far as it's concerned, it's talking to a modem. So it's wonderful. You're using the internet as a conduit, kind of your dial tone, so to speak. Your PCs are gateways and everything else is retro. It's just like being back in the day. And I did this with two or three BBSs. I found some information on how to do this and some good links were on Jeff Ledger's Guide to Tel BBS. And the link on that is kind of long. I will have it up on the show notes. Of course, you can also Google for that. It's Jeff and the last name Ledger, L-E-D-G-E-R. And there are some great links off of that page. You should check them out. And if you're interested in doing this, Those links and the information contained therein will give you everything you need if you want to start BBSing over the internet with your retro computers. Now, I had a null modem cable to connect my two computers, but some of the lines, some of the wires were not exactly the way that they should be for optimal tel BBSing. So I pulled out the soldering iron again. It seems like I'm pulling that out more and more as I work with this retro stuff. And I modified my null modem cable so that it would have the right pin configuration to do this telnet BBSing. After I did that, everything was smooth sailing. Anyway, fun. And again, I was prompted or inspired to do this based on this BBS documentary. Now, I've got some, for lack of a better term, some footage or some audio segments that I captured from this BBS documentary for this week's show. And I'll talk about them as they come up. Again, it's licensed under the Creative Commons. Not only is it possible, but actually encouraged to do this kind of a derivative work. And a million thanks to Jason Scott for making that possible. A direct quote from him from his website is this. Jason says, quote, "I think the history of the BBS is important for people who are using the internet to know about. As someone who grew up using BBSs, I knew I wanted as many people to see it. Getting money out of every single person who watched it ever for all of time was not a goal." So he has a extremely enlightened and a historical advocacy kind of perspective on this. So thanks again, Jason. You know, I'm going to definitely have a plug here for you and your documentary on the show notes. The URL for this is pretty easy. It's www.bbsdocumentary, that's all one word, .com. Now, the rest of the show may seem like something of a commercial for Jason's documentary. It's not intended to be that way at all, but I did want to point out that I'm exceedingly respectful of the license that Jason Scott chose for this documentary and the enlightened approach that I talked about. And without hesitation, I would definitely send any business his way that I possibly could. So, with that said, let's go for some of the clips that are in his documentary. All of these are from episode one, and there are actually 8 episodes in this documentary. It's just fantastic. Now, a warning to listeners that may be somewhat time constrained. Our typical show is 30 minutes, and we may run somewhat over that today. In fact, I wouldn't be surprised if this turned out to be a 45-minute show. So, hey, you know, if you got to check out, just try not to slam the door on your way out. But if you can stick around, we got a bunch of interesting material. At the end, I'm going to get a little philosophical on you based on some of the content that was in the BBS documentary and some other historical stuff that I've read about. In any event, clip number one, this is a short one. It's just 20 seconds. And it's Ward Christensen speaking. He's the co-founder of the very first bulletin board system that ever existed called the CBBS. Ward Christensen also created Xmodem, the program and protocol for reliably transferring data over a modem. In this portion, if you were watching the video, you would see Ward sitting next to the actual first CBBS machine, the first bulletin board in history. And to be honest with you, it looks kind of like antiquated test equipment, but it's an extremely historical piece of hardware. So I found it quite interesting. Anyway, here's this clip, and right after that, I'll be back for some more.
What I have next to me is the first bulletin board in the world, CBBS Chicago. People wondered if the C stood for Christensen or Chicago or whatever, and no, it didn't, because there was no such thing as a BBS, so it was a computerized bulletin board system.
And in this next clip, clip number two, we hear Ward talking about when he got his Altair computer, and also when he met up with Randy Seuss, the co-creator of the first BBS.
1974, I learned about microcomputers, and the 8008 was out at the time, and asked what I needed to know and got into digital electronics. And in 1975, the January issue of Popular Electronics had the Altair computer on the front cover. And I thought, oh boy, I don't have to design and build my own computer from scratch. I can actually buy a kit and have the fundamentals. And I didn't do it right away because I didn't want to be the only person with one. Hard to believe that that's now as universal as they are. So I went ahead and bought an Altair. There was this computer club that was meeting in the Chicago area, and CASH, the Chicago Area Computer Hobbyists Exchange. And that's where I met Randy, and he was the real hardware jock.
In the next clip, you'll hear both Ward Christensen and Randy Seuss talking about the birth of the CBBS bulletin board system. Turns out it was initially just a means to facilitate some of the club business for their Chicago-based computer club called CASH. It happened on January 16th, 1978, during a snowstorm, that the spark, the idea for this thing happened. And here you'll listen to Ward and Randy talking about that.
January 16th, 1978, I went out to go to work, and it had been snowing most of the night, and I was unable to get out because it just kept snowing and kept snowing. So I think I shoveled for like 2 hours and probably came in at like 9:30, 10 o'clock and realized I was not going to work that day. So I called Randy and I said, you know, I've got the computer club recorder where people can call to find out when the next meeting is and to leave questions and things like that. And why not take that line and put a system on it that people could upload newsletters and things like that, newsletter articles and so on, and we could do a club project. And I remember he said essentially that was sounded like a neat idea, but forget the club because you know what a committee run something will be. It'll take it forever to happen.
I had too many years in the Navy to know. No, let's not talk about it. Just do it.
The two of us will do it, and you do the software, and I'll do the hardware. And tell me when are you going to have the software ready? You know, like a project manager.
The reason everything worked out so well is that we just kind of inherently understood each other. He let me do what I did. I let him do what he did.
It took me about 2 weeks, probably about the end of the month, before I had some software ready to test. And a little bit of playing around and let a few friends know it was there and try it and get some early feedback on things that it needed. Basically, after the 2 weeks of designing and testing and put it online and refined it a little, and we called it a month, so February 16th became the sort of arbitrary birth date of it. And it happened so quickly because of Randy's brilliant initiative in pulling it back from being a club project, which would take forever and would be something more like the ARPANET that I had been in, which had a lot of people talking about a lot of good ideas, but nobody was just getting down and actually plugging in their soldering iron, so it wasn't happening.
The whole BBS thing was for our computer club to be able to produce newsletters. That was the whole idea of it. It worked. From wherever it went from then, fine.
And that's how this beast came out of it, and ran for many years. And I don't claim to have done anything special. And it was sort of like if you bring two more than half critical masses together, it's going to happen. And that was what was happening to the technology at the time.
I think based on the contribution that they made, both of those co-creators may have been just a little bit modest in their words there. They had quite an impact on the community, but it's true that sometimes things just do kind of evolve organically when the conditions are right. And we'll talk a little bit more about that toward the end of the show. The next clip is kind of humorous. Actually, it's a downright hoot. At the time that the CBBS was made, microcomputers were not that common. And they were often available in kit form. But as the years went on, and not too many years as it turned out, just a handful, computers began to be more prevalent in homes and with hobbyists. Many of the people began to run BBSs. And most notably, lots of people in their teenage or young adult years were running BBSs and were sysops. And in this particular point in time, home computer commercials began to typify this introduction of home computers into mainstream consumer retail. Honestly, the next commercial which came from the BBS documentary, sounds more like a used car commercial than it does like a computer commercial, but this kind of shows you that this was breaking into the mainstream. Here, have a listen and possibly a laugh.
It's Crazy Eddie's greatest home computer sale ever, and Crazy Eddie's going home computer crazy with the absolute lowest prices anywhere on anything and everything in home computers. Atari, Texas Instruments, Commodore, even the new low-priced Timex Sinclair. Crazy Eddie's got them all the latest software too. Shop around, get the best prices you can find on home computers, then go to Crazy Eddie and he'll beat them. It's Crazy Eddie's greatest home computer sale ever, and Crazy Eddie's going home computer crazy. Crazy Eddie, his home computer sale prices are insane!
Crazy Eddie. Woo! Boy, this is years of computer retail talking, and I'm not sure that I would have bought my computer from Crazy Eddie. But hey, you know, maybe it was a great store. I don't know. Maybe some of you folks in the New York area, if any of you are listening, because it looked like that was the area code that this was in, maybe you bought your home computer from Crazy Eddie. I mean, maybe they launched you into your microcomputer career. So, hey, you know, go, Eddie. Anyway, in this next clip, some different people talk about the brand wars. If you were in microcomputers back in the day, you remember this, and I've talked about it in previous podcasts, that people had obsessive loyalty to the particular brand of microcomputer that they purchased very often. I mean, some folks were, you know, reasonable, like normal about it, but other people just totally got into, I'm a Commodore person or an Apple person or an Atari person. And these rivalries extended to the BBS systems and, as you'll hear, even beyond. So listen to some of this. It's actually kind of nuts, but very interesting.
There was a serious rift between any of the 8-bit users, between Apple, between Atari, between Commodore.
I refer to them as Ford versus Chevy arguments. There was always this big argument between people who thought Chevy was the best car make and people who thought Ford was the best car make. And there were always this rivalry and this fight between them for what seemed like a completely pointless thing.
People get really, really heated. They get very, very defensive of their computers. It's not like you go and you buy a stereo or you buy a blender or a toaster. A computer is a very, very personal thing. It's an expression of how you want to work, how you want to do things. It becomes an extension of yourself, and you tend to protect your own.
Each had their own group of followers. Each group of followers was very faithful to the company they chose.
Well, Ataris were the best computers ever made.
Forget it. The Apple II was the only software thing in town.
The Commodore, I think, did more to get people into computers than anything else on the planet.
When you thought of Atari, you thought of the highest quality, you know, the best games, the best, you know, the best of everything. So it made sense that, you know, if they come out with a computer, God, it's got to be the best thing around.
The Apple was the ultimate hackable piece of hardware.
The Lisa was beautiful, so I fell in love with Lisa.
Tandy did have a great computer, which you may be talking about, the Coco, the color computer.
64, it was everywhere.
They're great, because they're the coolest. You understand what's going on with an Apple II. It's not going to trick you. Nothing sneaky is going to happen on an Apple II.
They break down, you put them in the closet, and they heal themselves.
The Commodore is definitely the one that I have like 10 of them at home, just in case. I'll have one till the day I die.
And a TRS-80 guy would never own an Apple, and an Apple guy would never own a TRS-80.
I think I didn't like the Commodores, just the way they were shaped.
Actually, IBM was kind of like the enemy.
The trash 80s were toys.
I remember seeing people, you know, viciously attacking people nonstop in the message boards. They were people that I would actually follow a guy around and keep an eye on him and keep lashing out at him and on multiple, bulletin boards. I mean, it got that serious.
If you were a Commodore user and you were on our bulletin board, it had to be because you told us you had an Atari or an Apple or a PC. We had zero tolerance for Commodore. And not for any practical reason, except for the fact that you have to delineate yourself from somebody else. We're the Commodore free zone. So that's what we were.
So that was probably where a lot of the emotion came from. It's like, why are you making fun of my computer? You know, it's a computer just like yours is. But
this extended off of the bulletin boards, these wars, because you would walk into a store and you would hear some Commodore kid that would see somebody looking at an Atari computer getting ready to buy it, and they go, you don't want that. It's not powerful enough. It can't even run a disk drive. It can't run this. And I remember myself personally stepping up and going, you know, and getting involved in that and saying, you don't know what you're talking about. You know, we have robotic arms. We have Corvus disk drives. We have this. We have that. We have all these sorts of things. And you'd see the two people that were kind of looking at the computer to be kind of like, you know, stepping back some way, like, you know, okay, let's you know, let's get out of here.
One of the local electronics stores had set up a BBS that they were running out of their electronics store on this Amiga. And, well, that just would not do.
Right.
And so various people at various times would go up to the store, and they would have this BBS just running on this PC, and they would disable that BBS.
Yeah. Just take it off mouse ball,
you know, just, you know, remove the mouse ball, set it aside, yeah, or do something. So now they can't do anything on their computer.
I remember him making threats against the sysop of that. Now, he was 16 probably, and the sysop was an employee of the store. And he's like, you got to take your board down or, you know, something bad is going to happen. I remember him coming home and saying, I just followed the guy home from work and I threatened him from my car and told him, you know, you got to take your board down. And I'm like, what in the world are you doing? And so then we stole the mouse ball from this computer, and he posts this plea on the bulletin board. Anybody who knows where my mouse ball is, because this is a time when you can't get replacement parts for the mouse balls. Anybody who knows where a mouse ball is, please let me have it back, you know.
The biggest advantage it had, that, you know, I couldn't put this to words then, but the biggest advantage was that I had one.
I mean, that's like really something. People following each other in their cars, people stealing equipment from bulletin boards because they're not run on the right platform. crazy days. But I remember those platform wars, and I was steadfastly in the Commodore camp back then. Some of my friends were Atari folks, and we'd throw little clever jabs at each other. I think sometimes they weren't quite as clever as they seemed at the time, but, you know, it's kind of humorous, but we didn't take it that seriously. I never stole anything, and I never followed an Atari person home and threatened them from inside my vehicle, okay? Just, I never did it. Anyway, another interesting thing is how far we've come in terms of communication speed, and this next and last clip for this particular episode will give you some insight into that, starting at 300 baud and working its way on up. Here it comes.
The first difference, the huge difference that's not, it'd be trivializing it to overlook, is the huge difference in speed. We're talking 300 baud. 300 baud.
I'm glad I will never have to again, and by saying this, I'm cursing myself. I'll never have to deal with 300 baud again.
In the bad old days, an acoustic coupler had two speeds. There was 110 baud, and there was a whopping 30 characters a second, 300 baud. And we thought that was pretty good.
300 baud. The screen wouldn't, you know, you'd log into a BBS and it'd be like, login, or username, colon. And you'd type username, hit return, and be a pause, and it'd go, password. And just how long it took to draw that stuff alone, because of the speed issues, was torture.
When 1200 baud modems came along, the users all saying, you need to go to 1200 baud. And I said, 300 baud, that's reading speed.
When you actually connect to 1200, it was absolutely amazing.
Called one of the few in town that supported 2400 baud, one of the few boards in town, and it was awesome.
You would actually seek out the place that had 2400 baud so you could take advantage of this high speed that you had. Even if the place sucked, it was just like, whoa, but look how much faster it's coming through. This is so cool.
But I was always 3 lowercase o, lowercase o, slash 12 lowercase o, lowercase o, slash 24 lowercase o, lowercase o, because I remembered the early days when I wasn't allowed onto some boards because I didn't have high enough baud rate.
I remember the first time when I called up to a board and a sysop pulled me in a chat and says, I got this new 9600 baud modem, man, and like, you're still 2400 and it's sad, what's wrong with you?
I probably got like $800 for my bar mitzvah from various people. It added up to $800. I spent 650 of it on a 9600 baud modem, which I thought was a good investment. $650 for a 9600 baud modem, which of course, as soon as I bought that, they dropped down in price.
And when I could get a 14.4 modem and download Doom to play with a kid who ran a BBS, because he couldn't find anybody to play Doom with him, that was just a wondrous device.
One particular Saturday night, I'll never forget, I had company at the house with playing cards or whatever. This guy called me bored and he's uploading something or other. And the next morning I woke up and he was still uploading the same program.
When you found the big file and it was across the country, you really thought about it, whether you wanted to download it now or take a chance on finding it locally. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
It's interesting stuff. You know, I hate to admit this, but some of my first interactive computer work that I did when I was in high school was with a teletype machine, one of the old clunky original teletypes, and a roll of paper tape that would go through and would get printed on. And we had an acoustic coupler that we could use to contact the main computer, the mainframe master blaster that was running at the central location for Los Angeles Unified School District. And we would dial up, we'd hit that acoustic coupler, and that teletype machine would kick into action. And if you've never had the pleasure of listening to one of those when they're in action, it sounds kind of like how would I describe it? It's almost like a jackhammer. I mean, the thing would kick on, and of course it was slow, and I mean, at 110 baud, naturally, you could imagine the thing just went really slow, and you type in, and then the output would come back, and you'd be chung, 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 ka-chung. Man, you know, those were the days. But, yeah, 300 baud was slow, too. And I definitely remember the days when a Hayes 300 baud external modem with all the nice red lights, you remember those? They were fairly pricey. And then, of course, the 1200 and the 2400, and like they were mentioning, the 9600. I remember when 9600s came out, one of my friends laid down quite a bit of cash to get one of those 9600 baud modems so that his BBS would be the most spody in town. And may get a chance to talk to him. Actually, an interview with him is one of the things that I'm hoping for on the part two of this RetroBits podcast on BBSs. So those were the clips that I wanted to play. Another interesting fact from that BBS documentary is that at their peak, there were over 150,000 BBSs just in North America alone. It's just astounding. But I remember in the day, I mean, I'd get the BBS lists for the Los Angeles area. And of course, you know, that's a highly populated area. And the lists were literally a mile long. And there were always local numbers for me to call. Nowadays, there are just a few hundred BBSs remaining. But remember, as I mentioned earlier, there's a renaissance of these BBSs due to Telnet BBSing and actually some more people putting up BBSs because of this. Like I mentioned before I started, the preceding audio material was just from episode one of this BBS documentary. There are eight episodes in total, and they cover topics like the evolution of the BBS, the relationships between sysops and users, commercializing the BBS world when the money got into it. They talk about FidoNet, a worldwide network of BBSs where BBSs would actually call each other and exchange information. They talk about the art scene, which continued the art of making pictures from ASCII, something that started all the way back to the teletype days. Another episode covers the end of the BBS scene in the mid-90s, when the advent of the internet hit and the board slowly started to turn down. And then the last episode covers a well-known controversy in the BBS realm regarding some compression program technology and some of the people and personalities behind that. All in all, an extremely interesting documentary series. Really well done. If you watch this series and then you are hungry for more, there are actually additional interview clips that the producer of this series is putting up on the archive.org site. Just check on archive.org under the BBS documentary section. You can find those, and there will be a link in the show notes about this. And be sure to visit www.bbsdocumentary.com for more information on this. So, with all that said, some observations. Like I warned you, I'm going to be a little philosophical here. First off, I think that in this documentary, Jason Scott has done a great service. He put in an awful lot of work on this, and he and others that are embarking on projects to preserve history for the computer age really deserve our thanks. I mean, people who are writing books, people who are producing videos like this, it's just great that this history can be captured close to its actual point of occurrence, so that too much of the information doesn't get lost and go by the wayside, because, you know, this computing thing is actually kind of important. It's changed all our lives, and having some of the history of it is a good thing. Now, some points that have kind of come to my mind as I watched this BBS documentary and have read some other computer history texts, like some books on Apple, the book Fire in the Valley that I mentioned. It seems like in a lot of cases, success on a particular technology or the advent of some popular trend comes about because the ingredients necessary for that trend came together at the right place and time. The people who make those changes happen are frequently the ones who just, to be honest, get up and do it. Many, many people are capable of making changes and making improvements, but it's the ones who actually jump in with their ideas who turn out to be the movers and the shakers. I've seen this again and again and again, the people who just, you know, stop talking about it and get up and do it. Kind of like what Ward Christensen was talking about. He and Randy Seuss had that conversation. They said, you know, we're not going to drag all of this into committee. We're just going to do it. And they did it, and it was groundbreaking. Another thing that I've observed is that everything has a life cycle. Now, in technology, these life cycles move kind of fast. But in essence, they're just a fast-moving reflection of other historical trends. It's just that in technology, you can see a whole full cycle of something like that, or actually several full cycles during a single lifetime. So, but it's interesting that these same trends that you see in historical trends are true. Things rise up, things thrive for a period of time, and then things taper off. I guess the most famous historical example being the Roman Empire, but other empires have risen and fallen, other trends have risen and fallen, and you just see it really fast in tech. So it's like a little microcosm of greater society. Even the internet that seems so entrenched today and has become so much a part of what we do and how we work, I'm convinced that someday it will be a story for the history books. And, you know, the way things move, that could even happen during our lifetime. Who knows what is just around the corner? Another point that I saw, technology is cool, and I love technology, but often the most interesting stories with a lot of these technologies, including all this retrocomputing stuff, are the stories behind the people and the interactions between the people. Like all other history, like all other kinds of things, this is all about people. It's how people act and how they interact. And when we learn about these things, you know, I can speak for myself, reading these books and learning about all this stuff, it makes you a better person. And it also gives you some more tools in your tool belt. It helps you to predict the kinds of challenges that new technologies and other kinds of changes might bring in the future. Another thing I've noticed is that just because something goes out of vogue or doesn't happen to be the most optimal solution for contemporary needs doesn't mean that it isn't still enjoyable. In fact, sometimes it's really interesting to look at and appreciate older things and see the advantages. Like, for instance, I have a book. I'm not an old book collector, but this I was passed down to be me by my father, I have a book that was printed in 1747. It's not particularly rare. I've talked to some people about assessing it. It's probably worth not much more than $50 in terms of value. But it's interesting to me because it's so darn old. I mean, over 250 years old. The binding is made of rope. The pages are still completely readable. And I have to wonder if any of the books in my bookshelf right now are still going to be around 250 years from now, or if anybody's even going to care. So it's just interesting to see how they made that, the care that went into the production of those things. Another example, LPs, or vinyl records, are considered somewhat retro at this point. I mean, not too many people have turntables anymore, but lots of folks swear that LPs do produce better sound. And I guess last, but definitely not least for your taste buds, even though you can get killer ice cream at the store, just walk up and pick it up out of the freezer, some people prefer to still pull out the ice cream maker and churn their own. I have never had any homemade ice cream. Is that crazy or what? I feel deprived, but I've never tasted it, but I've heard that it's wonderful, and it'd be interesting to see how people make it old school. And likewise, bringing this back around, there are charms to BBSing that the internet of today may not match. One thing involves the strong blending of the online and local community. With these BBSs, people would get together and have parties, I mean face-to-face parties, because usually the BBSs you were calling were in your local area, and people would get together. It'd be a way for people to connect. And BBSs had a primarily interactive style. When you were on a BBS, you were interacting with the machine, versus when you're web surfing, you know, let's face it, a lot of web surfing ends up being a passive activity. You're going out to get the news, you're going out to listen to music, etc. Now, many would argue that the internet accommodates these kinds of things with the Usenet discussion groups and online web forums, and, well, I guess that's just it, many would argue. Many would argue both sides of that equation. They would say that the internet experience of today doesn't match what people had on the BBSs. So I guess, luckily, there's room for both. We still have BBSs, and we've got the internet. So it's a good thing. We can see both sides. And finally, for me, a really cool part is that retro computing is historical. But it's a piece of history that has the added benefit that you can play with it. You can actually tinker with it and make it do cool things. I mean, take it out and poke on the keyboard and read about it and learn about it. It's still a lot of fun for me. And just like the old days, people are still inventing new stuff for these old 8-bit creatures. So, like we say here, it's old school computing, but modern day fun. So that's my first report on BBSs. Like I say, we'll probably have a part two on BBSs where I'll get with some of the people that I knew that were sysops and BBS users and talk about some of their experiences and maybe blend it in with some other stuff. That's it for this week's podcast. I thank you for sticking with us since we're running a little long today. As always, thanks for listening. Again, you can find information about the show, including all the links that I talked about in the podcast, at our podcast hosting site, Retrobits, retrobits.libsyn.com. And you can send us email at retrobits@gmail.com. Now, the one thing my wife pointed out last week is that I used the word us when, in fact, it's really me. So I guess when I say you can send us email, it's kind of like the royal we. So, but you know, with a podcast and a production, it just sounds better to say us than you can send me email. I don't know. It flows a little bit better. But so, you know, forgive me for my use of the royal personal pronouns here, and if I can figure out a better way to express it, maybe I'll do that. But there really is only one of me. It's the one who's sitting here making the podcast for you, but with your emails and with the various resources that are out there, I'm never doing it alone. It's always the Retro Computing team. So again, I'm rebooting for now. Have a fantastic week, and we'll talk to you next week. Bye-bye.